Good afternoon, Regent Radio. This is Omesama Rahemtullah, joined on the line by Dr. Gerald Horn after a week's absence, but we are back. Hello, Dr. Horn.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, and yourself?
Could be worse.
I'm glad it's not. And I just want to let people know that it is Thursday, late afternoon, so that's where we are in terms of the news. And a lot going on, a lot to discuss. I thought today we would start with all the elections going on. So Tuesday afternoon, we saw an inconclusive election in Italy that gave none of the parties a parliamentary majority. And of course, at the same time, the former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has been placed under investigation on suspicion of bribing a senator to change sides in parliament in 2006. So your analysis of what seems to be a busy week in Italy?
Well, I think it's important on this report to do what the mainstream of bourgeois press usually doesn't do, which is provide some context. What listeners should know is that after World War II, after 1945, Italy had a very strong left-wing movement, actually the strongest communist party in Western Europe, if not in the North Atlantic community. And it was the sworn aim of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, including Canada, I'm afraid, to destabilize that particular Communist Party. I recall, in particular, the 1947 election in Italy, where the United States basically appealed to its large Italian-American community to get in touch with their relatives in Italy to make sure that they voted non-communist or anti-communist. You might also recall that a few decades ago, Aldo Moro, who was a Christian Democrat leader, prime minister of Italy, was leaning towards what was called the historic compromise, that is to say, forming a government with the Communist Party. And so what happened? Somehow he was kidnapped, the prime minister now, kidnapped, and then murdered, believe it or not. I mean, this is sounds stranger than science fiction, but it's true. In fact, there's been some interesting Italian dramatizations and movies about the murder of Aldo Moro. So this brings us to the most recent election in Italy. And now, of course, there's no longer a communist party, at least by name. They go by the name of the Democratic Left, and they were expected to do well. Of course, they've been pushed to quite a bit towards the center in favor of privatization and all the rest. And their candidate, Pier Bassani, did not do as well as expected, which is not surprising because they lost a lot of credibility, not least because of the blows they've suffered from NATO. Then Mario Monti, who was the so-called technocratic candidate, he was put into the prime minister's office after Silvio Berlusconi, who you just made reference to, was nudged out. Berlusconi was nudged out because, of course, he's a clown. You may be familiar with the term he's introduced into the English language and not the Italian language, bunga bunga, which refers to the orgies and sex parties which he helped to make famous. Of course, he's being investigated because of supposedly paying money to an underage young girl to have sex in one of these bunga bunga parties. So he's basically a clown. And then, of course, there's the actual clown, Beppe Grillo, whose five-star movement did quite well. But he says he doesn't want to participate in the government for whatever reason. You may also know that Beppe Grillo won't be entering the parliament because not only is he a comedian, but he has criminal charges hanging over him. He's been convicted of manslaughter, amongst other indelicate offenses. Now, let's step back for a second and analyze what the import of this Italian election is. Part of the import is that the Italian people did not want austerity. They did not want higher taxes and lower services, which is what they got from Mario Monti, a prime minister who was foisted upon the Italians, not least because of the Germans. And it's very dangerous that there was a very strong anti-German feeling to these Italian elections. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, was really vilified during these Italian elections, some might justifiably, but it's quite ominous But what's not ominous, it seems to me, is that austerity is being rejected by electorates across the board. And that raises a particular dilemma, which is that if the electorate rejects austerity, i.e., higher taxes and lower services, but the elites want austerity, well, then something has to give. And usually what gives, if you look over the past 100 years, is that the elites basically decide to circumscribe democracy, because they say democracy doesn't work because people are not voting for austerity. And that's where we are right now. And that's one of the many reasons why these Italian elections were so important, because it indicates to the North Atlantic elites that it's going to be very difficult to get austerity through an election, unless, of course, you're talking about the United States of America, where you have a backwards white American population that votes 60% for the Republican Party, even though many of them are poor and working class, but they vote for the Republican Party because they think austerity means that black people will get it in the neck. Somehow they don't seem to realize that it also means they'll get it in the neck, too.
And so where does this impasse then leave Italy? What are, people are saying that that's going to force an election in the next 6 weeks to a couple of months. Where do you see that leaving Italy right now?
Well, it's possible there will be another election, because since Beppe Grillo and his five-star movement don't want to enter the government, it may not be possible for the Democratic left to form a parliamentary majority, which means there may be another election. But that it's also a sword hanging over the head of the five-star movement, because many of these parliamentarians going into parliament in Rome, they don't want another election because, you know, being a parliamentarian in Rome is a pretty nice gig. You know, get a nice job and all sorts of perks, whereas another election, maybe they won't be going into parliament. So there are going to be a lot of negotiations taking place over the next few days. What's remarkable, it seems to me, about this election, among other things, is the resurrection of Silvio Berlusconi. I mean, he's been left for dead more than a mummy. But he seems to have more lives than a cat. I mean, this is maybe his 10th life, not his ninth life. And so it's amazing how he keeps nudging himself into a charm circle, a charm political circle, despite being despised by so many. I mean, for example, The Economist, the British magazine, which speaks with authority for the North Atlantic elites, basically hates Silvio Berlusconi. They've done just a real hit job against him in recent months and years, but obviously he has a constituency. You may know that Silvio Berlusconi, he started off as a crooner on a cruise ship, and then he migrated from that somehow to becoming a billionaire owner of a soccer team, Forza Italia, which also is his political slogan, and also a controller of a deal of the Italian mass media, particularly television. And that's part of the secret, if there is a secret, to his being able to resurrect himself. That is to say, he can pipe his message directly into living rooms throughout the breadth of Italy.
And last week, when we weren't able to speak, but Ecuador's President Rafael Correa has been reelected to a third term in power in Ecuador. Your comments?
It's good news. That's good news. It's very good news. I mean, if there is any ray of hope in terms of a progressive movement, an anti-monopoly movement, it's coming from South America. And this election in Ecuador, where Rafael Correa is one more bit of evidence in that regard. Keep in mind that a few years ago, there was an attempted coup against him that he stared down rather forcefully. Keep in mind also that Mr. Correa, even though he received his academic training as an economist in the United States at the University of Illinois, has been a stern critic of U.S. imperialism. In fact, he will forever be renowned for telling Washington that Washington, the United States, has shut down its military base in Ecuador unless Ecuador could open a military base in Florida. And, of course, the United States thought he was stark raving mad by making such a proposition, and they have been trying to destabilize his regime ever since. But the people of Ecuador vote for his citizens' movement because they see results. They see that the oil wealth of Ecuador, which heretofore had been controlled by Chevron, which had the U.S.-based oil monopoly that has befouled the environment in Ecuador, that now that oil wealth is going for roads, it's going for schools, it's going for hospitals, and that's the secret, if there is a secret, to his being reelected.
And another election that's going to be taking place on Monday, that in Kenya. And of course, tensions are high given the violence of the post-election. The last time the Kenyans went to the poll, many people are commenting, writing their opinions. I caught yesterday Ngugi wa Thiong'o's optimism. He says that he's cautiously optimistic that there will be peaceful acceptance of the election results. But of course, he's fearing that, you know, this is a new generation. This is the first generation, Raila Odinga and Uhuru Kenyatta, that weren't personally involved in the anti-colonial struggle, and that this is a new generation, but a new generation that still continues to mimic Western counterparts in terms of their greed and corruption. So a lot going on in the run-up to these elections. There was Uhuru Kenyatta, of course, who is being tried under the ICC, and the Kenyan courts just ruling on the 15th that he could stand for election. So your take on the Kenyan elections? It seems that Raila Odinga is ahead in the polls.
Well, of course, those names, Kenyatta and Odinga, gives us a sense of deja vu all over again. That is to say that those were the names from the early 1960s. That is to say, Kenyatta and Odinga, that is to say, the fathers of these present leading contenders. And I guess that suggests that there's a kind of political dynasty that's operative in Kenya. I think that Raila Odinga got off the best line during this presidential debate, in recent presidential debate in Kenya, making reference to the ICC, International Criminal Court, action against his opponent, Mr. Kenyatta, said that it would be difficult for Mr. Kenyatta to run the government by Skype from The Hague, which, of course, many people laughed at. But you may recall that we talked a few weeks ago about Thaksin Shinawatra of Thailand, who managed to have his sister elect prime minister, and he's basically been running Thailand through Skype from Hong Kong and from Dubai and from other places where this billionaire investor tends to land. So actually, the last laugh may be on Raila Odinga. But in any case, what is not humorous at all is the prospect of violence. And what's interesting about Kenya is that in some ways, Kenya has a very sophisticated telecommunication system, in many ways more sophisticated than the United States and perhaps even Canada. What I mean is that in Kenya, mobile phones have deep penetration amongst the masses, and people pay many bills basically through their mobile phones. Also, texting has taken off like a rocket in Kenya, but the problem is that the texting through mobile phones has been used to send what is commonly referred to as hate texts. That is to say, texting tending to impugn the ethnic origins of particular neighborhoods or particular communities. Speaking of which, another problem that Kenya faces going forward in this election is what has emerged that could be fairly characterized as a certain persecution of the Kenyans who are of Somali origin. You know, of course, about the decomposition of Somalia over recent decades, which is only being reversed in recent months. And what's happened is that many in Nairobi, in particular, feel that, number one, the so-called pirates who have been capturing ships off the coast of East Africa and the Indian Ocean and garnering thousands, perhaps millions of dollars, the argument is that they've taken that money and pumped it into Nairobi real estate, helping to inflate prices But of course, from the point of view of the, quote, pirates, unquote, that's a very sound investment because Kenyan real estate is tending to appreciate because Kenya is becoming, as it always has been to a degree, the economic headquarters, not only for East Africa, including Tanzania, all the way down to Mozambique, but also to a degree for Central Africa, including Uganda and Congo. And so the Somalis are being blamed for higher real estate prices. They're also being blamed because there have been a number of explosions in Nairobi and in Mombasa to a degree on the Indian Ocean coast in recent months, and Al-Shabaab of Somalia has been blamed. And this has led to retaliatory violence against the Somali community in Kenya. So the situation is getting ever more complicated. But what's interesting about Kenya is that you have these great spurts of violence before and during elections. But then after the elections, it tends to recede. And let's hope that's the case this time, too, that after next week's election, this violence will tend to recede.
And we'll definitely talk about the outcomes of that election when we speak to you next week. Moving on to Mali with a bit of a Canadian twist. Robert Fowler, who was a former Canadian diplomat, was a hostage 4 years ago in the region. And he is, I guess, chastising John Baird for cutting funding to Canadian troops and the Canadian military because they are the department plans to cut $170 million from its $2.6 billion budget over the next 2 years, which will impact Canada's role in Mali and also the diplomatic contingency in the West North African region. So I guess your reactions on Robert Fowler's, I think he was speaking in Parliament, and then an update on Mali.
Well, what's interesting about Fowler is that a CBC journalist called me the other day to talk about Amakar Cabral. And in the context of that conversation, I found out that Robert Fowler has been making, in my opinion at least, not according to the journalists, I don't want the journalists to be on the hook for this, Robert Fowler has been making these really disparaging comments about African leadership, contemporary African leadership. And I have to say, I was, maybe I could be considered naive, but I was really not only disappointed, but a bit irked. Because here you have a situation where the United States in particular, and NATO in particular, waged a war against African nations who were trying to build socialist projects. I'm thinking of Angola and Mozambique, beginning in the 1970s in particular. And you had UNITA in Angola and RENAMO, MNR in Mozambique. And, of course, we could go up and down the continent with similar sorts of destabilizing efforts. And so they forced these regimes away from redistributing the wealth. Samora Machel, the leader of Mozambique, you may know, was killed by the apartheid authorities. His plane was guided into a mountain, and the plane crashed, and he was killed. And so what happened, of course, is that in order to get out of wars, these regimes moved away from redistributing the wealth, and they moved towards capitalist projects, and that meant that the NATO countries, the United States, and of course Canada as well, the government that Robert Fowler serves, then ended or eased the wars against them. So what's the result? Look at Angola as a case study. During the wars, you had the MPLA, the Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola, which styled itself as a socialist-oriented party and was trying to redistribute oil wealth. NATO, including Canada, said, you can't do that. Okay, fine. Now what's the result? The richest woman of African descent in the world, richer than Oprah Winfrey of the United States, is Isabella dos Santos, who is the daughter of the president of Angola, who, of course, was the leader of Angola during the time it was trying to build socialism and decided to retreat from that. Now, so here you have this character, Robert Fowler, who's hiding under his desk at best when these wars are going on against African countries. And now that they're involved in these capitalist projects that are leading to further impoverishment and the creation of billionaires like Isabella Dos Santos, now he comes out of the woodwork and denounces these African governments for their policies. Well, I'm sorry, Robert Fowler. You should have been speaking up in the 1970s and the 1980s instead of being a careerist climbing the greasy pole of success in Ottawa to become an ambassador. And I would have thought, Robert Fowler, you would have learned something from being kidnapped in Mali by those conservative religious radicals who your government in Ottawa helped to support precisely in the 1980s to defeat socialist regimes in Northern Africa and Afghanistan and elsewhere. So excuse my irritation, Omid, but when I was told this about Mr. Fowler, I have to say I sort of lost it. Now, with regard to Mali, this is going to be a major quagmire, I'm afraid, for the North Atlantic countries. Basically, in recent days, you've had the killing by the radicals, conservative religious radicals, of a number of Chadian army forces. There have been attempted car bombings. The conservative religious radicals are armed to the teeth. The African countries, who are supposed to be supplying troops, have been rather slow, shall we say, to bring those troops. So France is basically sinking into the sands of the Sahara sooner than some of us expected.
And I guess moving on, we don't have too much time left, but I wanted to talk about Palestine and an update on that, and you kind of maybe predicting the emergence of a new intifada. But of course, related to that and the regional politics is the question of Iranian nuclear armament. There has been talks between Iran and six world powers that ended on Wednesday with specific agreements being met. So could you talk about those two related issues?
Well, with regard to the Palestine question, a number of issues. There was the killing and detention by the Israelis of a Palestinian prisoner, which has led to mass unrest in Palestine. Some are predicting the emergence of a new intifada, a new uprising against Israeli colonial rule. You should also know that Israel is under fire from the international community because there has been the migration into Israel in recent months of a substantial population of Sudanese and Eritreans fleeing political persecution, and under internationally recognized norms, Israel should not be sending people back to their countries of origin who face a reasonable fear of persecution. But Israel has been doing precisely that, and credible reports have emerged that when the Sudanese in particular have returned to Khartoum, that they have faced persecution, which is causing intense criticism of the Israeli authorities. Also causing intense criticism to Israeli authorities is the continued persecution of the Ethiopian Jewish population, many of whom were enticed to leave Ethiopia some years ago. And now credible reports have emerged of concerted attempts by the authorities to give the women of these communities certain birth control devices and drugs so that they will not be giving birth, thereby increasing their number. I know this sounds like bad science fiction, but you can go to your news sources and double check what I've just said. This also is taking place in the context of continued tension between Israel and Iran. The latest news, in addition to what you just made reference to, these talks taking place in Kazakhstan between the Iranian authorities and the P5 plus one, that is to say the permanent five members of the Security Council plus Germany. What has come out of those meetings is a press report, a news report, that recall we talked on this program about the North Korean nuclear test that took place some days ago. According to press reports, there were Iranian officials on the ground in North Korea when this tests supposedly took place. And according to this press report, this was a joint test between Pyongyang and Tehran that edged Tehran closer to getting nuclear weapons. Now, I'm not giving credibility to this report. I'm only repeating what is now believed in Washington and Tel Aviv. Also believed in Washington and Tel Aviv is that Iran may be edging closer to a status, a nuclear status, close to that of Israel, which does not acknowledge that it has nuclear weapons, even though it has close to 100 or 200, but has them nonetheless. And so the idea is that Iran will develop, according to Washington, nuclear weapons, but just won't acknowledge it. This adds a particular momentum to the impending visit to Israel of U.S. President Barack Obama. I dare say that when he meets with Prime Minister Netanyahu, who still hasn't cobbled together a parliamentary majority to form a new government, and quite frankly, Israel might be facing new elections too. But in any case, when he meets with Mr. Netanyahu, it would not be surprising at all if some sort of joint military attack was on the table taking place before the end of 2013.
Sorry, Gerald, you got cut off there at the end. Can you repeat just the last two sentences, maybe?
Oh, that when Mr. Obama goes to Israel within the next week or so, do not be surprised that if press reports reveal that Israel and the United States are planning a joint military strike against Iran because of these, I would say, unfounded suspicions that it has nuclear weapons. And I dare say that if that takes place, it would be opening the gates of hell. It would be creating a gargantuan international crisis.
To say the least, yes. In the last couple of minutes that we have here, a Bangladeshi domestic crimes tribunal that was set up in 2010 to seek justice for victims of the 1971 War of Independence from Pakistan has just sentenced Dilawar Hussain Saeed, who's the vice president of the country's largest Islamic party, the Jamaat-e-Islami, has been sentenced to death. Your take on that?
Well, what's interesting about Bangladesh right now is the mass movement taking place. First of all, recall a few months ago, there was an unfortunate tragedy at a factory leading to the deaths of a number of workers. Workers in these plants that make clothes that you then see on the bodies of individuals in Toronto and New York and Paris and London. And of course, the workers get a pittance and the clothes are expensive. And what happened was that apparently a factory owner shut the door, and when there was some sort of fire, the workers were not able to escape and they perished. And that's led to an explosion of trade union energy that is still coursing throughout Bangladesh. Then there are these student protests. Students, like students in many countries, students in Bangladesh have a heroic history. And they have been protesting, claiming that this chap who has just been convicted should be given the death penalty, because originally, apparently, he was not. They say that during the Bangladeshi struggle for independence some decades ago against Pakistan, that this particular organization committed what they would consider to be war crimes, what they would consider to be atrocities. But in the greater scheme of things, I think what's important about Bangladesh right now is these mass protests of workers and students. And I would also say, just one more note, that in some ways, Bangladesh is walking in the footsteps of their compatriots, their comrades in the eastern part of India, particularly in Kolkata, or the city we used to refer to as Calcutta, which historically has had one of the most developed and strong progressive movements, workers' movements, radical movements in Asia, if not the world.
And we have come to the end of the time that we have today. But if I may, if you may make a maybe 30-second or one-minute comment on the Oscars this Sunday, I'm sure you are watching or maybe following, being the film critic that you are. I guess the only film that, or the only category that I was following this year was the documentary. None of the Palestinian or the Palestinian-Israeli entries won that prize. But your take on the Oscars?
Well, I saw 5 broken cameras last night. That was the Palestinian interview you just made reference to. It's worth seeing. It's easily available. I won't tell you the sources, but you know, you can find it very easily. Interestingly enough, the filmmakers got arrested in Los Angeles Airport when they arrived, which was a welcome to the USA kind of greeting, I must say. Argo, which was the film about the Iranian hostage crisis, the U.S. hostages taken hostage some years ago, won Best Picture. And, of course, the Canadian ambassador at the time is up in arms because he feels that Canada's role, as usual, got short shrift from Hollywood, which is not a shock to anybody who pays attention. I should also say that the Iranians don't like that film, understandably, because it portrays them in a very negative light. I think what's interesting as well is that Lincoln, which is more U.S. propaganda, it won't do very well abroad, which is very important because Hollywood makes most of its money abroad nowadays. But Django, the film about rebellious Africans, also about slavery, probably will make more money because it shows the United States, I would say, in a more accurate light, in a truer light than Lincoln does.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us again this week, and we'll definitely talk to you next week.
I hope so. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.